GCC International Limited. Mr. Rader, we're ready to proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. We're here today on an appeal from entry of a preliminary injunction, and the issue at the heart of this appeal is the District Court's erroneous construction of Claim 58 of Canon's 018 patent. This Court's review of that construction, obviously, is de novo. Now, before I delve into the details of Claim 58, I'd like to just take 2 minutes of my time to provide a brief factual background that I hope will put the claim construction issue into a proper context for the Court. As you know, the issue is whether Claim 58 covers a toner cartridge alone by itself or in combination with part of the printer, that is, the part of the so-called inventive coupling that resides in the printer. Now, this Court's adjudication...
If it's the former, you lose on the repair reconstruction issue,
correct? Correct. This Court's adjudication of the issue of whether it's the cartridge or a combination of the cartridge and at least part of the printer will determine whether Canon can succeed in stopping companies like GCCI that make replacement parts for consumers of Canon printers to repair those printers with, whether Canon can stop companies like GCCI from competing in the marketplace. Now, GCCI only sells cartridges, so it doesn't sell printers. So if the claim covers any part of the printer, GCCI cannot directly infringe. In order to stop GCCI and companies like it from competing, Canon has to have a patent claim on the cartridge alone without the part of the inventive coupling that resides in the printer. And that's why we're here today. Now, just one more word of factual background about GCCI before I delve into Claim 58. GCCI makes toner cartridges that are compatible with printers sold by companies like Canon. But just to be absolutely clear, all of GCCI's cartridges are independently designed and engineered and manufactured. They're not copies. And in fact, if this cartridge that we're talking about today was a copy, we would not be talking about the 018 patent. As Your Honors are aware, Canon takes the position that the 018 patent, in fact, does not cover its own cartridge, and that there's a different patent that covers that. So this is not a case in which there was a copy. This is not a copying situation. The case isn't about that. The case is about whether Canon can succeed in stopping competition in this replacement market for replacement toner cartridges, and whether it has done what it needs to do and met its burden to stop that competition despite the default repair rule. And what it needs to have done is two things. Number one, it needs to have invented a cartridge that in and of itself is novel without the part of the coupling that resides in the printer. And number two, it needs to have patented that cartridge. Our position, as Your Honors are aware, is that Canon, one, did not invent such a cartridge standing alone, and two, certainly did not patent it. That leads me into the discussion of Claim 58. Claim 58 is a somewhat unusual claim. As Your Honors are aware, the lead authority that we've cited throughout our briefs is the Vicon decision, and there the Court made a similar observation that the claim was, quote, a difficult one to make sense of. And the reason is because although the preamble begins with the words a process cartridge, or in that case it was an emergence cuff, it then goes on to describe in excruciating detail structure and limitations, not of the cartridge, but of the main assembly of the printer.
Yeah, well, that's the problem. This case is not like Vicon in that respect. The hull is not defined in excruciating detail. It's not defined in a way that goes beyond the structure that relates to the coupling feature.
The hull is defined as being a hull defined by twisted surfaces. And the question under the Vicon analysis, which focuses on whether there are limitations in the claim that pertain to that other structure, what Canon calls the environment, in this case, the main assembly of the printer. The Vicon analysis focuses on whether the claim defines limitations that would be meaningless with respect to the cartridge, the thing that Canon says the claim should be construed to cover. That's the Vicon analysis, and when you apply that to this claim, what you see is that there are multiple limitations in the claim that, in fact, would have no meaning if the claim covers only the cartridge.
Which is not?
There are several of them, Your Honor. Probably the most notable, because we brought it out in our opening brief and Canon had no response, is that the claim says the projection on the cartridge, that's the male piece, and the twisted hole in the printer, that's the female piece, have to contact, quote, at least 3 points.
But that's describing the coupling between the cartridge and the hole. That doesn't seem to be extraneous to the coupling.
I agree with you, Your Honor. It's not extraneous to the coupling. It's extraneous, though, to the projection. And the reason why is that for any projection that you can imagine, if you're holding a cartridge in your hand with a projection of some sort, you can always devise, hypothesize, or in language of the Vicon court, imagine a hole, a twisted hole, that would contact it at 3 points. And for that reason, to say that the hole has to contact it at 3 points provides no limitation whatsoever on the cartridge. There is no cartridge and no projection that limitation would ever exclude. We raised that point, and there was no.
What about one that has two prongs? They gave an example in their brief, one that had three, I'll call them prongs, that's 3 points. Suppose it had only two prongs. Wouldn't that be one that would only touch 2 points instead of three?
No, Your Honor. You can always consider a hole that would undulate and would meet that projection at 3, 4, 5, any number of points that you desire. And it's similar to the situation in the Vicon case where they talked about a cuff that had to meet the taper of an abutment, and you could always hypothesize an abutment that would meet whatever the cuff looked like. The same thing is true here.
I'm having a lot of trouble following your argument. As far as I can tell, Vicon has nothing to do with this case, and neither does Stencil, neither does any other case, because it all depends on how the artisan would read the claim language at hand. Seems to me we ought to be talking about the critical language of this claim, not very tortured attempts to analogize this case to Stencil or Vicon or any other case. I mean, the preamble says a processed cartridge, mountable, and then it describes some other parts of the assembly. And then the preamble ends by saying said processed cartridge comprising. So as far as I can tell so far, it's a cartridge. It's not a printer. It's not a cartridge and part of a printer. It's just a cartridge. So far, I don't follow you at all. So then I guess you have to be saying, well, when they refer later in the body of the claim to the twisted surfaces, they must be claiming the twisted surfaces. Is that your point?
That's correct, Your Honor. Later in the
body. I don't follow why that would be so, because it doesn't say a projection with a twisted surface. It says a projection for engagement with a twisted surface. When I read that, all that tells me is that's how it functions. That's its purpose. It doesn't tell me anything about its structure. This is a claim drawn entirely to structure. So I think that functional language in the claim doesn't constitute a claim limitation. And this looks to me like it's purely functional language. Purpose for engagement with. So I don't think the twisted surface is part of the claim. It's not a limitation.
May I respond, Your
Honor? Well, I hope you will, because otherwise I'm just not with you at all. I'm not getting anywhere down the road you want me to go down with you.
Well, I think a couple of points. Let me start here. The key question, Your Honor, the court in Vicon, and many other decisions, I'm not going to focus only on Vicon, has made quite clear that one of the policies of claim construction is to give meaning to all the words in the claim. Now, if the claim is going to describe the way in which one thing operates with another, okay, then the question is, how do you give any meaning to those limitations? So, for example, I talked about the 3 points of contact. This claim also says that, and it uses the word when. It says when they're engaged. This is column 29, line 62. When the driving or table member rotates with the hole and the engaging portion of the projection engage together, there are a number of things that happen. One of the things that happens is that the twisted nature of the hole, it actually draws or urges the projection into the hole. Now, what does that language mean? The language is right there in the claim. It has to have some meaning. If you imagine in your mind for a moment that the claim covers only the cartridge and no part of the printer, it doesn't cover the twisted hole or anything else, how does the language that the hole has, that the projection has to be urged into the hole, in any way limit the cartridge? It doesn't. Your Honor, what determines whether the projection is urged inwardly or outwardly is the way, the direction in which you rotate the hole, counterclockwise or clockwise. It's like a nut and a bolt. Turn the nut clockwise, it's going to urge the bolt in. Turn it counterclockwise, it's going to urge the bolt out. So that claim language would have absolutely no meaning if this claim were directed to a cartridge alone. It would never exclude. The inwardly language would never exclude any cartridge.
The question is it a limitation at all? Certainly the case law says every limitation has to be met for infringement, and there are no superfluous limitations. But that doesn't tell us whether a certain phrase constitutes a limitation or not. I'm suggesting to you that the phrases on which I assume you're depending don't constitute limitations. If that's correct, then all the case law you're talking about is totally irrelevant. If it's incorrect, then the opposite conclusion has to be drawn.
Your Honor, even Canon concedes explicitly in its brief, and conceded to the district court, that all of the description in the preamble and the body that pertains to the main assembly of the printer is limited. They concede that. They agree with us on that. What they disagree with us on is in what way it's limiting. And what they say is it's a near environment or reference point, which is...
Yeah, but the environments are not limited. They're not claim limitations.
Well, Your Honor, in addition to the plain language of this claim and the fact that, my view, under the BICON analysis, which says when you have a claim that describes the interoperation of two things, and part of the language of the claim that describes that interoperation would not limit the one, it has to encompass the combination. I think that's the clear holding of BICON. There's another way of looking at this, Your Honor. A couple more ways of looking at it. But let me start with this one. If you pick up the GCCI cartridge, and you hold this claim in one hand, and the GCCI cartridge in the other hand, Your Honor, you cannot tell whether the cartridge infringes this claim by looking at the cartridge. If this claim covers supposedly the cartridge, you ought to be able to tell from looking at the cartridge in the claim whether it infringes. But you can't. You can hold the cartridge in hand and look at it and ask yourself, well, will this be drawn inwardly or outwardly? The only way you can answer that question is to know something about the printer that's not even in the claim. You have to know something about a printer that exists out there in the world somewhere. If that's the case, how can the cartridge possibly be the only thing that this claim is drawn to? The public would not know how to interpret this claim and would not know how to determine infringement. So that's one way, I think an important way, of looking at this issue.
Can I shift you for a moment to the other issue here, which is one of obviousness, but there's a serious question on obviousness.
Sure.
I look at the records, it seems to be two competing experts. One say that the claim is obvious, particularly with the death impact, and they said no. And the question is, does this raise a serious question of obviousness? This seems to me to boil down the question of what's meant by the term process cartridge in the claim, whether a process cartridge implies that the user can easily replace it, or whether that's not part of the definition of process cartridge. What's your position as to whether a process cartridge has an easily replaceable element as part of the definition?
Well, a process cartridge, of course, is a replaceable element of the printer. The issue that Your Honor is describing is that the expert for Canon said, well, one of skill in the art would not have been motivated to combine...
It's a question of whether a service technician has to do it or whether the user can do it.
Correct.
So is the definition of process cartridge, does that assume the ability of the user to do it? Because if it does include the ability of the user to do it, your expert doesn't address that. It doesn't seem to be or have been raised a serious question with it.
Well, it was through the lens of whether a service technician would be needed to change this thing that Canon's expert said one of skill in the art would not be motivated to go from a gear-type coupling to...
No, but you're not answering my question. My question is my claim construction. Does the term process cartridge used in this claim imply that it can be replaced easily by the user, or would it include also a cartridge which has to be replaced by a service technician?
As a matter of claim construction, Your Honor, I don't think you can make that distinction. I think that distinction comes into the analysis of motivation to combine, but I would not say that as a matter of claim construction, you can read the word a process cartridge in the claim and say that that implies something very specific about how easy or how difficult it is to change this this thing in the machine.
But you put in no expert testimony about the meaning of the term process cartridge within the industry, right?
That's right, but Canon's expert also didn't opine on that specifically.
I'm not so sure about that. I think they did.
If I could just address this point, though, a little bit further about whether it's easier or not to employ the screw technology of Canon's prior art Japanese application versus the gears that was clearly in the prior art. The problem, and we pointed this out, I hope clearly in our reply brief, Your Honor, the problem with that analysis that Canon's expert opined on and that was adopted by the district court is that the reference itself, the prior art reference itself, says that there are advantages to using the screw over the gear. And specifically,
yeah, I understand.
Okay. I won't belabor that point.
Thank you. Time has expired.
Can I just ask a question, Michelle? This procedural context in this case is an appeal from a grant of a preliminary injunction. We're talking about claim construction, but we're not at the end of the case. And not even the district court has construed claim 58 in light of the entirety of all the claims that have to be construed. The district court has made findings that the balance of the hardships favor Canon. You can dispute that. The judge made those findings. And therefore, isn't it logical or sensible that in a preliminary injunction context, Canon doesn't have to be determined to be right? All that Canon has to be determined to be is to have a reasonably good possibility of being right enough to balance against the balancing of the hardships. Therefore, it's not quite the same thing as saying that to sustain the preliminary injunction, the appellate court has to say, absolutely, this is the way it'll come out, but that there's a substantial likelihood it would come out this way.
Your Honor, you're referring now to the claim construction issue?
The entirety of the issue is likelihood of success, which is only one factor in the four-factor analysis for preliminary injunction.
Well, look, I'd be happy to address all of them, but since my time has expired, unless you have questions, let me just focus on the likelihood of success that Your Honor is asking about. Respectfully, I don't think that it would be an efficient use of judicial resources for the court merely to address whether the district court judge's claim construction has a reasonable likelihood of being correct. I think now that we're up here on appeal, that what would make most sense would be to get a definitive ruling from this court on the claim construction issue now, rather than going back. Of course, the district court judge, in the remainder of this proceeding, is going to apply the claim construction that he came to in the preliminary injunction proceeding.
Maybe not. He may well modify it. It frequently happens. He'll have a fuller record. He'll have more time. Maybe new considerations brought to bear.
It's possible, Your Honor.
All right, thank you, Mr. Cannella.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. To persuade this court to overturn Judge Castell's grant of a preliminary injunction, it's GCC's burden to demonstrate that the district court abused its discretion and committed a clear error of judgment.
Or he committed an error of law, which is what he alleges, namely a grossly inaccurate claim construction, in which case abuse of discretion is not the operative standard of review. The correctness, at least in the context of which Judge Garvis reminds us of a preliminary injunction is the issue. So it's a de novo review.
I absolutely agree, Your Honor. It is a de novo review. And on claim construction, I invite the court to make that de novo review. I invite the court to examine the evidence which Judge Castell examined to see if the court reaches the same conclusion, because I am confident the court will reach the same conclusion. This claim, Claim 58, is directed purely and simply to a process cartridge. It cannot be contorted or distorted by commercial motivation or litigation-inspired argument into a claim to a combination of the cartridge and the printer. Judge Michel, Chief Judge Michel, I also agree entirely that the outcome of claim construction in this case is not predetermined by the decisions of this court in other claim construction cases, Bicon, Stencil, or anything else. But Judge Castell did not apply Stencil to predetermine the outcome in this case. He said Stencil is illustrative and illuminating and instructive, I believe is the exact word, because Stencil demonstrated that you can, in fact, claim a component within its environment without that claim becoming converted into a claim to the combination of the component and its environment.
Law precedes Stencil, succeeds Stencil, not in doubt. It all depends on how you do it. It all depends on the language and how the ordinary artisan would read the language. So the generalizations, in my view, are no more helpful to you than they are to your opponent.
Well, Chief Judge Michel, then let's turn to the specifics which Judge Castell turned to in doing his claim construction. I won't belabor them because the court has made observations that make clear that the court knows most of the evidence.
Not so fast. I'm very troubled by all this language. If it has no meaning, why is it in there? Why is the claim drafter talking about the twisted surface if the twisted surface has nothing to do with the structure of the cartridge?
The twisted surface is in the preamble of the claim, Your Honor, because the twisted surface provides...
I'm talking about the portion of the claim body that reiterates about the twisted surface. And then about the driving rotatable member, and about the hole. I mean, those are all parts of the machine external to the cartridge. So if the claim isn't something more than the cartridge, what is all this language doing in the body of the claim?
That language in the body of the claim is just a recitation, again, of the environment within which this cartridge and its projection works.
Why would the environment need to be repeated? It's already been stated in the preamble. So when the claim includes extensive clauses and phrases describing certain of the printer machine parts, it looks to me suspiciously like the drafter is trying to tell the reader something new and different than environment. He's already covered the environment. Now in the body of the claim, he's saying something new and different, it looks like to me.
Quite to the contrary, Your Honor, I believe the drafter is doing no more than explaining how this projection mates with the environment, the unclaimed environment of the preamble. Certainly Canon can claim its inventions in any fashion that is in accord with the patent law. They could claim it in combination, they could claim the separate components. Instructive on that point is this court's decision in the Anton Bauer case, which although is a case that deals with implied license.
How can we tell whether the projection, that's a structure within the cartridge, is going to be urged inwardly of the hole or not?
Well,
if we don't know something about the geometry and the dimensions of the hole.
I think the inquiry, Your Honor, however,
if the projection is too short, nothing is going to happen.
I think the
inquiry, too long, it might also not work. And so, by referring to being urged inwardly of said hole, maybe the claim drafter is, in effect, defining the dimension of the projection. telling us the distance of the projection, but perhaps also the thickness of the projection. Could have described it otherwise. Could have said it's 1 centimeter long and 1/10 of a centimeter wide. But instead of doing that, he did it by reference to the part with which it's going to meet. So that suggests that this is an important part of the definition of the projection, the structure and dimension, shape and length of the projection itself. Why not?
I think not, Your Honor. When my adversary says if you take the cartridge and claim 58, you can't determine if it infringes. But that's not the correct way to go about determining.
Is he right about that?
No, he is not, Your Honor.
Not right about that?
No, because you can't pull the claim.
I'm sorry. The suggestion is that there's extraneous language here in claim 58 which doesn't help you to look at the cartridge and determine whether it infringes. That it only helps you once you put the cartridge to use in the hull. Is that not true?
It is not true, Your Honor. The language in claim 58 simply provides the environment. The balance of the 018 patent, the specification.
That's mush. You're not really telling me. Is there language in here that describes how the thing fits into the hull, which tells you more than you need to know when you're looking at the cartridge itself? In other words, you can't tell whether the cartridge infringes without looking at, one, the cartridge, and two, how it's used with the hull.
That is true, Your Honor. But one looks... It isn't. I don't believe so, Your Honor, because one looks not to claim 58 by pulling it out of the patent and divorcing it from everything else and every other disclosure in the patent. One looks at claim 58 within the context of the patent. And certainly...
But if there are 59 claims and all 59 are asserted, then I, as the accused infringer, need to be able to separately analyze each one of the 59 claims, including claim 58, because my liability can be based on that one claim alone. Therefore, I have to be able to tell whether I'm infringing or not. I deserve to be put on fair notice as to each and every claim because it's a separate basis of liability. And if Judge Dyke is correct that you can't tell whether the particular cartridge infringes or not by just looking at claim 58, then that suggests to me that there isn't fair notice to competitors.
The reason for that, Your Honor, however, comes from this court's precedent on how to do claim construction. This court has never said, pull the claim out of the patent and determine what the claim means.
Nobody is suggesting that you ignore the other claims or the specification or the summary of the invention or any other part of the patent doctrine. No one has made such a suggestion. The concern is, how does one know, reading 58, the way you would have them read it, whether a particular cartridge infringes or not?
Because you construe claim 58 by looking at the plain language of claim 58, by looking at the specification of the patent, by looking at the prosecution history.
To determine infringement, you've got to look both at the cartridge and at the hull. You cannot determine infringement just by looking at the cartridge, right?
You can, Your Honor, because once you understand what the hull contains, by looking at the specification and the descriptions in the specification.
But you've got to look in a particular case to determine whether it's infringement. You can't just take the cartridge. You've got to look at the cartridge together with the hull to find that there's infringement, right?
Which is yes, Your Honor, but which is a fair infringement analysis. Because as this court has said time and time again, to do the infringement analysis, first you construe the claim. You construe the claim by looking at the claim, the specification, and the prosecution history. Only then, when you have an understanding of the claim within the context of the patent and the specification, does one look to the cartridge. With the knowledge base of what the entire patent provides, one can look at the cartridge and determine that the cartridge meets all of the requirements of claim 58. I believe, Your Honor, it's simply a matter of performing the construction and the infringement analysis in the proper order. Not simply pulling out a claim and saying, with just this claim and knowing nothing else, can I determine whether I'm infringed? That is often the case in patents. You can't pull the claim out and determine whether you infringe until you've studied the entire patent, all the claims, the plain language of those claims, the specification, and the prosecution history. So
In essence, I believe that argument is without merit, Your Honor.
Are we, this may be naive.
We aren't making arguments. You and Mr. Rader are making arguments. We're just asking questions to try to learn about the case. Judges don't have positions in cases. We aren't making arguments. We don't have contentions. That's your job as advocates. So don't be ascribing to a judge an argument. We aren't making arguments. We're just trying to learn.
I appreciate the observation and apologize, Your Honor.
Let me ask you perhaps a naive question, perhaps. We're at the assembly line. The assembly line off has come a cartridge that's the accused device. Somebody picks it up. A patent attorney picks it up at the end of the assembly line. Company says, does it infringe or not? Can he sit there and say it infringes, or does he say, wait a minute, let me go over to a Hewlett-Packard printer, and then I'll tell you if it infringes? Is that, can you answer that?
Yes.
All right. You can look at it and say, this infringes.
No, he can't look at it and say this infringes, but he doesn't have to go look at the Hewlett-Packard printer. He has to do what this court has said he has to do to make an infringement determination.
He's got a copy of the patent.
He's got, I'm sorry, Your Honor, I did not understand from your question that he had the full patent and the specification with him when he was looking at the cartridge. Armed with those devices and the cartridge, those pieces of paper, I should say, and the cartridge, he can make the infringement
determination. Does the patent show the dimensions of the twisted surface and the dimensions of the projection that mates with the inside of the twisted surface?
I believe not, sure.
Well, then how can you tell if it infringes? If the projection is too short to reach the place where it would have to mate, then it's not going to mate. It's not going to work.
And it's not going to be sold.
Well, I mean, that's neither here nor there, whether it's going to be a popular product or not. On the issue of whether you can tell whether a given cartridge infringes or not, the only way you could tell would be if there was some dimension, either in the plain language itself or in the rest of the specification. You say there isn't a dimension in the rest of the specification, and we can see ourselves that there are no dimensions in the claim language. And therefore, I don't see how you can tell whether a given cartridge infringes or not until you try to put it into the overall machine. What am I missing? How could you tell other than by putting it in somebody's printer and it either fits or it doesn't fit?
Because it doesn't have to work in anyone's printer in order to infringe this claim.
Well, that's the issue in the case. That's circular.
No, I believe not, Your Honor. The infringement here is established if they make a cartridge which meets the limitations of Claim 58. Whether that cartridge can subsequently be used in a Canon printer is not an element of infringement. It's only whether they make a cartridge which meets the limitations of Claim 58. But now, in the facts of this case,
you can't determine whether the limitations of 58 have been met just by looking at the cartridge. You've got to look at the cartridge and you've got to look at the hole. Right.
No, you do not, Your Honor. You have to look at the cartridge and you have to look at the rest of the Claim 58 and the rest of the patent. You don't have to look at all.
Well, if it's, you get the printer, if it's now at this point, it has to have projections that will be driven inwardly, so to speak. I assume I can look at the cartridge and I can imagine a twisted hole can have any shape in the world. I guess I can imagine a twisted hole that won't drive it inwardly. Does that mean it doesn't infringe? Because this is a cartridge, and it'll infringe some twisted holes, and it will be driven inwardly with some, and it won't be driven inwardly with others, without regard to whether it was counted likewise.
The body of the patent itself illuminates what the configuration of the twisted hole is.
The problem is that there are many claims in this patent, the vast majority of which, I guess you agree, are combination claims, which is not good. So if I'm looking at the whole patent, you may be forcing this into a combination conclusion.
I know. Judge Garbus, I disagree that most of the claims are combination claims. Most of the claims are to individual components, either process cartridges, some photosensitive drums, or the printer apparatus. Your Honor, I see my light is on.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Rader. 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. Very briefly, Your Honor, so I just want to respond to one point that Mr. Cannella made. He said that the drafter in drafting this claim was doing no more than reciting the environment. And when the drafter wrote about the twisted surfaces of the hole and the other parts of the printer, he wasn't intending or making those part of the apparatus that's actually claimed. And here, I think it's instructive just to point the court, we certainly do in the brief, but to point the court to the prosecution history. In the prosecution history, arguing the claims over the prior art, the patent attorney, the drafter of the prosecution history, so to speak, used the classic language that patent attorneys use, that this court sees time and again, to argue that the prior art that had been cited lacked a substantive limitation of the claim, not the twisted hole. He said that the prior art Suzaki patent, quote, fails to teach or suggest at least the feature of the twisted hole, unquote. In litigation, Cannon argues that it was just the environment, but during the prosecution history, Cannon argued that the twisted hole, that the prior art failed to disclose or suggest that. That is the classic language that patent attorneys use when they are arguing that a substantive limitation of the claim, not a reference point, but a substantive limitation of the claim is absent from the prior art.
Is that argument made with regard to Claim 58 or other claims?
That argument was made, not with regard to Claim 58, Your Honor. There were two claims that stood rejected. The argument was made not only with regard to those two claims, but with regard to an additional claim, a third claim, and then was applied to every independent claim in two ways. First, by virtue of the fact that all of these claims recite the twisted hole and the projection interaction in exactly the same way. So to the extent that the argument applied to the two or three claims that were being argued, it must apply in the same way to all of the claims since the language is the same. And secondly, the patent attorney argued that all of the independent claims were allowable quite, quote, over the cited art for the above reasons. The only cited art that had been discussed was the Suzaki patent and this argument. So there are two independent reasons why this argument applies to every claim in the patent, not only the two claims that still rejected.
All right, thank you. We'll take the case under advisement.